Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon, looking for a high temperature of 82. Then we'll start the weekend tomorrow with mostly sunny skies and a high of 85. It's currently partly cloudy and 78 degrees. Checking Valley traffic, an accident I-10 westbound at Central has the HOV lane closed. Also a collision on the 60 eastbound at Higley Road.
Maricopa County has confirmed its first pediatric flu death of the season. As KJZZ's Phil Latsman reports, it follows an announcement by the state that the flu is now widespread in Arizona.
The victim is described as only a school-aged girl. Dr. Bob England, director of the Maricopa County Department of Health, says it's a sad reminder we're in the midst of a full-blown flu season and that vaccinations, while far from a cure-all, are still recommended for everyone 6 months and older.
Frankly, the flu vaccine isn't as good as we wished it was, but we can still take more than 90% of the flu away if we simply get enough people vaccinated.
Last year, one child died from the flu in Maricopa County. Although the number of adult deaths is not reported to the state, it's estimated about 300 die from influenza each year in the county. Phil Latsman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A former surgery technician has pleaded not guilty to federal charges of stealing painkillers intended for patients at a Colorado hospital. 28-year-old Rocky Allen entered his plea today. He's charged with tampering with a consumer product and obtaining a controlled substance by deceit. Prosecutors say he took syringes filled with painkillers at Swedish Medical Center in the Denver suburb of Englewood and replaced them with some other substance. Swedish asked about 2,900 people who'd been patients there to be tested for hepatitis and HIV. John C. Lincoln Medical Center in Phoenix, where Allen previously worked, also offered testing.
There was lots going on at the state capitol this week as lawmakers continued their work. Joining me to talk about some of what they did is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. And Howie, it looks like our New Year's Eves and 4th of July might be getting a bit more explosive.
Well, if you like to blow stuff up, there may be good news for you. Back in 2005, in fact, you couldn't even use party poppers. And little by little, the industry has come in and said, okay, now you can use party poppers. And then in 2010, they said, well, I'll tell you what, if you give us sparklers and smoke devices, we won't ever come back and ask you for anything else. Well, guess what? The industry is back, and they say, well, you know, now we'd like firecrackers, and now we'd like, well, you know, what they call keg mortars, which are preloaded mortars that, you know, shoot, you know, flares up in the air about 100 feet. And they're insisting, well, if you give us that, we won't come back for the rest of it. Arizona is one of only a handful of states that does not allow a lot of this kind of stuff, I mean, California being the other. Obviously, the fire departments are very concerned.
Another potential change could be in the way that we vote for president in the next election.
Well, this is going to get interesting on two different ways. First of all, we have had a presidential preference primary since 1996, and it's paid for by the state, but pretty much it benefits only the two parties. Well, guess what? There are more independents than there are Republicans or Democrats, and so the question is, why should the taxpayers keep paying for it? The bill that's out there would abolish the presidential preference primary, and it would be up to parties to decide how you want to nominate your candidates. The other bill that's floating around goes to the issue of the Electoral College. So rather than try to attack the Constitution and the whole concept of the Electoral College, one of the pieces of legislation floating around here says, we will enter into a compact with other states, and when we have enough other states that have at least 272 electoral votes, they will go ahead and agree to cast all their electoral votes for whoever got the most popular votes.
This was an especially busy week at the Capitol as bills start to work their way through the full either House or Senate and then move over to the other chamber. What are some of the other bills of note that you saw getting some final approval this week in one chamber or the other?
Well, there's a lot of changes being pushed in the state election code that are being crafted by the Secretary of State. Now, the Secretary of State's office insists, oh, this is just a cleanup of the laws that we've done. Well, I've got news for you. The head of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission says, I don't think so. I mean, he says what this basically does is makes things more opaque than other issues. We've got some abortion bills that are floating through to say that you can only have medication abortions for the first 7 weeks versus the first 9 weeks. We've got bills on fetal tissue research. We have bills, as you know, the governor did sign the JTED bailout, if you will.
The career and technical education programs.
Yes, the career and technical education programs. And, of course, what's fascinating about that, other than, A, the fight between the House and the Senate over who got credit, is that, B, when the governor signed it, he called it a victory, which is fascinating since he didn't want to restore all the funding. He only wanted to restore $10 million of the $30 million that was cut. There are a lot of other oddball things that are going on. Are we attacking sanctuary cities? In other words, if a city doesn't always call immigration, should they lose their state aid? If a city doesn't obey the state's gun laws, should they lose their state aid? Do you see a pattern here? You know, he who has the gold makes the rules. And speaking of gold, we've got a bill going through that says if you invest in gold coins and you make money on it, we're going to say it's not a capital gain because you're really only investing in money.
Lots of interesting bills still to come. Lots of interesting bills have happened already. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services covers them all. Howie, thanks.
Glad to be here.
Following in the footsteps of Colorado, Arizona voters may have the chance to approve a ballot initiative in the fall that would legalize marijuana use here. But a number of educators, including a group of recent state school superintendents, are strongly opposed. Among the former superintendents is Lisa Graham Keegan, who joins me now. Lisa, you're concerned about the potential impact of legalization on kids?
What we're seeing in Colorado is that they've gone to the point that they're 70% over the average for underage use of marijuana since the inception of legalized marijuana. It's a lot. And when people say, you know, this is about adults doing, you know, whatever they want to do, I understand the argument, except that that's not what the facts are bearing out in Colorado. And this is so dangerous for kids. This is something that can be life-altering.
And there are underage kids who smoke marijuana now, which, of course, we know is a fact. Are you concerned that by legalizing it, kids are going to get a different message from it, that it'll just be, well, if it's okay for them, why isn't it okay for me?
Well, that is the message. I mean, what the message is it's not a malevolent substance. You shouldn't be worried about it. Just wait till you're a little bit older. I don't know how you take that, anything but that message from we're now going to legalize this and everybody's going to be smoking marijuana as adults. The second issue is the facts, I guess, they more than one issue, just a whole bunch of facts in Colorado about youth. It just goes higher with legalization. It's not the case, as a lot of people predicted. Well, it becomes legalized, you get the same people, they just won't get arrested. That's not what happens.
Is there any way to build in obstacles to this based on the concerns that you have on this? Is there any way to write a possible bill or a possible ballot initiative that says we will increase enforcement, whether it's near high school campuses or something like that? Is there anything possible that Colorado's not doing that Arizona could do that might in fact quell some of these concerns?
I don't think so, Steve, and for the following reasons. First of all, marijuana these days is ingested in numerous ways. It's in liquid form. It's in vaping form. It's in food. It's in candy, which is very attractive, right, to children. The accidental ingestion is up, I think, in Colorado about 600%. I don't understand how you control sort of ubiquitous availability.
Those who are in favor of this particular ballot initiative are saying, hey, we will be sending extra funds from this to Arizona public school education, which, of course, as we know, even efforts that are being going on right now, another ballot initiative with state trust land and whatnot, there's obviously major concern about funding for education in Arizona. Do you buy that that will, in fact, help fund?
No, I'm offended by it. We will cost ourselves way beyond the $56 million they say it'll come to education and lost opportunity for children if we get anywhere near the uptake that Colorado's gotten. They're already having to pay more than that, presumably in sort of lost capacity in kids that have now taken this up when you're getting one of six of them addicted to this substance. I'm not going to get into what this does to adults. It's not my concern. What it does to young people is it stunts a lot of brain growth at a critical time. So, Steve, I see no way that we can tax highly enough to say, well, first of all, let's just toss away this predictable segment of kids because we can afford to treat them however we will have to once we create the sort of addiction problem. I'm offended by the argument.
Lisa Graham Keegan is a former superintendent of public instruction here in Arizona. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
But the initiative's supporters dispute all that. J.P. Holyoake is chairman of the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol. J.P., what do you think about the superintendent's opposition?
My first response was that this was a canned reefer madness response. And there are many items that they list in here that are factually incorrect. I mean, this is much of the same reefer madness propaganda that we're seeing from the other prohibitionists. With some of these studies that they cite, claims that marijuana leads to lower IQs, higher dropout rates, impaired cognitive function. I mean, these things have been debunked by credible scientific authorities time and time again. But they keep trotting these arguments out because they think that people simply won't do their homework and research.
What do you make of the money issue, that in a state that spends as much as Arizona does on public education, the amount of money that would come in from the taxation of marijuana is not significant?
Our schools are grossly underfunded, and marijuana legalization is not going to solve that problem. But it certainly puts a dent into it, and it makes a significant impact on this. The number that was in their article here was $58 million. Now, that's $58 million in year one that would go to public education rather than going to criminal drug dealers. I mean, this is really simple. Do we want to continue to enrich criminal drug dealers, or would we rather tax and regulate marijuana and put the money into education?
Is there something to be said for their argument, though, that when you say schools will get a lot of money from marijuana, when you look at it as a dollar amount, yes, it's a lot of money, but as a percentage, it becomes a much smaller figure?
Sure. No question on a percentage. It's not nearly enough. $58 million is the number that they used in this article. How much good will that do when that goes directly into the classrooms? Now, this is not money that's being taken from some other program in Arizona. This is money that's being taken out of criminal drug dealers and criminal drug cartels' pockets and instead put into Arizona. So they like to belittle the number on this. But if they've got another alternative solution, I'm all for it.
Is there a perception problem here that you think that should marijuana become legal, should voters approve this, that kids will think, okay, well, if it's legal, it must be okay to use?
No. We need to look at the same arguments with alcohol. We need to have honest conversations with our children about the relative harms of different substances. And when you lump marijuana into categories like methamphetamines and heroin, and you tell children, hey, look, these are all really bad. Well, you know what? Some drugs are really, really bad. But when you put marijuana into that category, it's disingenuous, and children are not stupid. They realize and they know that you're lying. And I don't think that lying to children about the dangers of marijuana is a successful strategy for keeping them away from it.
J.P. Holyoake is chairman of the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol.
One of the obstacles that usually comes up when people talk about making Arizona more competitive economically is the limited number of universities that are based here. But in recent years, the Valley has been a comfortable spot in the realm of for-profit education. Two major announcements this month, though, are likely to dramatically change that. The parent company of the University of Phoenix, the Apollo Group, is moving to go private, and Grand Canyon University, which has been for-profit for more than a decade, may become nonprofit again by this summer. ASU professor Barry Bozeman studies for-profit education and joins me now. Barry, what do you make of the Grand Canyon decision?
It's an innovative approach. I think the reason they're doing this is probably twofold. This is partly speculation. Number one, it's a time of shakeout for all of the for-profit universities, and many of them are scrambling to find a new life and a new incarnation for themselves. And then secondly, and we need to not overlook this, in many cases, people who run for-profit universities have the same motivations for good or ill. They're running a business, and they're trying to make money, and one of the ways that they can make money is selling their company. What often happens is the people who founded the company or in charge of the company, the CEOs, the CFOs, whatever, they make a substantial profit with the turnover of their company or the change of its status.
Does it help the perception, just based on how people view the greater industry, whether it's accurate or not, is it better for the university's reputation to be a nonprofit?
It probably is, only marginally, because I think with the students, the sort of traditional, everyday students that attend public or for profit universities. They don't really attend that much to those kinds of issues, but I do think that at the margins it will help them, particularly in light of the bad publicity that for-profits in general, I'm not talking about Grand Canyon, but the for-profits in general have been in the gun sights of the federal government and state regulators for several months now, and I think people are attentive to that, and so the nonprofit status will probably help them.
And also very dramatic changes recently with the Apollo Group. Is that also falling under the same things you're talking about as far as being in the sights of the federal government, or is that something more closer to a business model?
No, I think probably it's not the same. Here's some of the differences I see between Phoenix and Grand Canyon. In the first place, while Grand Canyon is not meeting its growth targets, it has been growing. And so there's not a big student exodus like there has been to some extent at the University of Phoenix. So the University of Phoenix, even though it's a much larger entity and still a powerful market force, they do plan on selling for about, I think the sale will come out to about $1 billion. They have had a 20% enrollment decline in the last quarter. So I think it's actually quite a different situation. And the status of the university is unlikely to change in terms of its legal status. What's going to change is its ownership.
How important is innovation to for-profits, even as opposed to traditional universities? Are they playing catch-up in more ways than one?
Well, I do think they have to find new ways of doing things because their primary competitive advantage in technology and services has evaporated. So it's certainly understandable that for-profit colleges are scrambling to find new ways to innovate, new ways to distance themselves from more traditional universities and find a niche they can play that's not already covered quite well by someone else.
Barry Bozeman, Professor of Public Management and Technology Policy at ASU.
Phoenix Startup Week is taking place in four Valley cities next week. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger joins me with more on this. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mark.
So what's the goal behind all this?
Well, they're aiming to grow and connect the startup community here in the Valley. The event is free, and it's open to anyone who's interested in entrepreneurship. There'll be more than 125 events held in Phoenix, Tempe, Scottsdale, and Chandler. I talked to Jonathan Cottrell. He's Phoenix Startup Week's community leader about this. And he's an entrepreneur, and he started the Yes Phoenix hashtag a few years ago to try to take the various pockets of entrepreneurial activity that were happening across the city and connect them. And he says he saw the impact of growing this kind of community at Phoenix Startup Week last year.
There were so many stories that came out of last year's event about the change in people's lives. And one guy, he took the entire week off of work. Sorry, GoDaddy. And at the end of that process, he said, "You know what? I have enough motivation. There is a community here, and I'm going to finally quit my job and actually start and continue the business that I've kind of started on the side." And he's killing it. He's just doing an amazing job. He's speaking this year.
I also talked to Christy Kerner. She's with the Center for Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University, and she's the founder of Startup Grind. She said that what they do at Startup Week can look just like networking, but it's much more than that. It's about helping each other.
It has come forward to be an amazing community that we have here that is just so dedicated to generosity and to helping new founders, anyone that engages in entrepreneurship or business in any way, just really welcoming them with open arms into a community that's very supportive and very encouraging and willing to help open doors and find ways to help each other create more success. Because instead of competing with each other, we realize that as we come together, we can really hugely impact the benefit of all.
And Kerner says as this startup community has developed in Phoenix, it's really developed its own identity, and that can have its own advantages.
You know, Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley. There will probably never be another place exactly like it with what they've got going on over there to support startups and the culture that they have and the level of support and connection over there. But that's okay. We have a different angle. Because we have less cash flow here, it forces our entrepreneurs to be a little extra scrappy and to really look at how to build something that can be sustained from as early of a point as possible.
And how does the startup community fit into the Valley's overall economy?
Both Kerner and Cottrell talked about the spirit of generosity that fuels the startup community here, and they think that generosity will only help individual businesses here find success. Here's Cottrell.
I met a lot of students last year that said, I'm not sure what I want to start yet, but I know that I want to start something someday. And so it just starts planting seeds and giving ideas and helping them realize that community is important to starting anything. We want to just continue to see that grow and to make our state one that isn't just focused on real estate development and isn't focused on these things that unfortunately are a little bit more prone to recessive economic activity, and really focus on things that also have stability, high growth capabilities, and ultimately building the economy, our home state.
That's Jonathan Cottrell, an entrepreneur and the community leader of Phoenix Startup Week. To find out more about it, including how to sign up, head to our website, theshow.kjzz.org.
KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
And Startup Week will kick off tomorrow with vendors who are just getting a foot in the door of the business world. In fact, the other foot is still in a classroom. The show's Annika Klein paid some of these young entrepreneurs a visit.
Kylie Clark, Kylie Brown, and Michaela Murray are playing outside. It's a sunny afternoon after school.
I can't get her.
But come Saturday, playtime will be over, and these girls will get down to business.
I'm selling beauty kits in a jar. They are homemade, and they smell really nice.
Clark and her friends will join more than 200 kids who will set up shop at the Arizona Children's Business Fair. Kindergartners up to eighth graders will sell items they've made themselves. In the past couple weeks, they've moved from crafting their products to crafting their pitches.
Hi, my name's Kylie Brown. Today I'm selling all-natural ingredient candles. I have lemon-scented candles, peppermint-scented candles, and lavender.
Brown was in the inaugural fair last year, where she says she made $600, a tidy sum for an 11-year-old. But she couldn't keep it all to herself.
Well, I had to pay my stepmom for all the supplies she got me.
It was a valuable lesson in profit margins. Her dad, Kyle Brown, is one of the fair's organizers. He says it began with a few other families who wanted to teach their kids about business.
And, you know, whether or not my kids end up being entrepreneurs or not, I want them to know and understand the value of entrepreneurship and how to create something, how to be creative, and really just think outside the box.
That includes learning how to adapt when things don't go according to plan. Michaela Murray sells smartphone cases she makes with a 3D printer.
My printer kept breaking. It's finally fixed and up and running again, but there was a little bit of loss of hope at times. But I feel like in the end, when you push through, it's more than just about making money.
Murray likes the freedom of making her own designs and being her own boss. The other girls agree. And when people ask them what they want to be when they grow up,
want to be someone who creates something big. And I want to inspire people.
Creating things that people like and I get a profit out of it.
I want to be someone who does what I like to do. Doing things with my hands, getting involved with tools. I feel like that would be something that I would do.
The cool thing is, they're already doing it. It's The Show. I'm Annika Klein.
As an organization, the Arizona Coyotes remain in flux. While they're getting back on track on the ice, their off-ice future is in doubt. So with all of that in mind, now their general manager Don Maloney is admitting that at the end of last season, he wasn't doing anything to try to improve the team. In sports, that's known as tanking in the attempt to get better and younger through the draft. To understand more, I'm joined by Brendan Porter, managing editor of the Coyotes blog, Five for Howling. Brendan, how do you interpret Maloney's words?
I think Don Maloney is sort of reiterating sort of a theme that we've seen for most of this year, which is that the team is still a work in progress. And I think that even though the Coyotes are outpacing expectations pretty dramatically and have been doing so all year long, Maloney still thinks that this is a team that's in the middle of a rebuild, that still has pieces they need to add, that still has players that need to get better.
I wonder, as someone who's covered the team for a while, do you think fans respond actually well to knowing that there is a plan of some sort, even if it is, hey, we're going to have to wait a couple of years to be good, as opposed to we'll sort of do the patchwork, we'll put a Band-Aid on this, a Band-Aid on that, to act like we're trying to be competitive?
I think fans know when they're not getting told the whole story. And I think fans recognize and appreciate when there's some candor involved. And certainly they know they're not going to be getting a particularly great hockey team, especially after, you know, a really bad season. But it does seem like Don Maloney is anticipating the fact that there are going to be some very talented players coming up. And I think he's also anticipating sort of a concern that a lot of fans have when you have these sort of really good players just on the cusp of making the NHL, which is that the Coyotes are simply not going to rush players anymore. They're going to take their time on their prospects, and they're only going to play them in the NHL when they think they're ready to play in the NHL.
Any reason to think Maloney's going to take flack from the ownership group for this?
I don't think so. I think if there is, it's going to be kind of minimal, because it's not like the ownership group has also been, I think, the kind of balance between active and distant from the on-ice operations that you really want to see from a sports ownership group. They're a group of guys that know when they're being sold a bill of goods that's not up to snuff, but at the same time, they don't think they can do it all themselves. And that's kind of, I think, the right balance that you want. And I think they really seem to trust Don Maloney.
It almost seems at odds with the NHL attitude and some of the other sports now as well, where they're really not giving coaches and general managers very long to turn around a program. Do you see that as a good sign, a sign of maturity as far as the organization's concerned?
I think it's just kind of a testament to the unique nature of this particular franchise, where the ownership group had to come in and almost basically start everything from scratch, and not just the on-ice product. You're talking about things like marketing and advertisements and television contracts and all of these various things.
What are the risks to the psyche of a team and the players on the team, especially when some of those players have been through the whole ownership thing over and over again? Shane Doan, obviously the captain of the team, has been through this a lot. Is there a thought that management should say to its players, hey, we understand that this might be tough for you guys mentally, but in the long run, this is best for everybody in the organization?
I think they're on the same page now. I imagine part of what the problem was last year and the reason why guys like Shane Doan just sounded so out of it was that the expectations were so high relative to where the team ended up performing. You know, you had, you know, Don Maloney talking about how they were in a winning movement more than a youth movement. That simply didn't pan out. There wasn't much winning at all. And I think that kind of disparity is something that's a real morale killer when you think you should be playing a lot better and you're simply not. I think now there's a much more realistic assessment of where the team has to go and what the team has to do.
Brendan Porter is the managing editor for the Arizona Coyotes blog, Five for Howling. Brendan, thanks.
Thank you.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report more than 25 countries with active Zika virus transmission and more than 80 travel-associated deaths from Zika so far in the U.S. Next week, scientists and scholars will gather in Washington, D.C. to discuss potential technical solutions like genetic engineering to deadly diseases, including Zika. Andrew Maynard, director of the Risk Innovation Lab at ASU, is one of the panelists, and he joins me. So, Andrew, what exactly are we talking about here?
So in this case, we're talking about taking the vector of the disease, those insects, those mosquitoes that transmit the disease, and working out how we can manipulate their genetic code, their DNA, to either get rid of the mosquitoes or prevent them from carrying the disease.
How do you do that?
With a lot of really smart science is the answer. So there's a bit of background to this, but over the last few decades, scientists have made incredible breakthroughs in how they actually program DNA. It's a little bit analogous to programming computers, but way messier and way more sophisticated, and we're really actually not that good at it yet. What we are beginning to be able to do is reprogram the DNA that defines what an insect or another organism is actually like, how it actually operates.
So does that mean that you would be able to, in theory, make a mosquito not able to carry the Zika virus?
In theory, we could do that. There has been research that has shown that we can do this with malaria-carrying mosquitoes. We don't know whether we can do it with Zika-carrying mosquitoes, but there's no reason why not.
When you're talking about reprogramming the DNA, even of something like a mosquito, which I think most people would say, mosquitoes, like nobody likes mosquitoes, right? But there must be some ethical considerations going along with this, right?
There are huge ethical considerations, all the way from, do we really want to eradicate or totally transform a species, even though we might not like it, all the way through to what happens when you release brand new human-engineered DNA code into the environment and we have very little control over it after that.
Do we have any answers to those questions?
No, we have a lot of discussions and a lot of opinions, but the reality is that we're still struggling to catch up with our technological capabilities here. And one of the big challenges, but also the big opportunities, is as a society working out how we use these really powerful technologies for social good.
Do you think that we will ever or could ever or would want to ever get to the point where we would be doing this with people, where we would say, you know, we don't like malaria, we're just going to make it so that in humans' DNA, we're not capable of having that?
Really good question. And this is an intense area of debate within the scientific community at the moment. Could we, should we genetically engineer people? And obviously, there are some huge ethical issues there. One of the more positive things here is if you look at completely changing what it means to be human. So we can do this with insects. We can reprogram a whole species of insect. We can't do that easily with humans because we reproduce so slowly. It would take hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of years for us to propagate this new genetic code through humans. But people are already looking at, can you take human DNA, work out what perhaps causes genetic diseases, and engineer out those traits by engineering the DNA in the fetus, so you end up with healthy babies, healthy adults. We can do that. The question is it ethical to do it? So to me, the really interesting thing here is how do we develop these technologies responsibly? We have incredible power here. We have very little regulation. We have communities that are really impacted by these technologies or potentially impacted. How do we deal with that? It's fairly common for sort of fairly well-off middle-class people, like we are sitting here deciding what the world should be like. But you think about Zika, you think about those communities in Brazil in particular that are dealing with the reality of Zika infections and the possibility of microcephaly. Those are the communities we should really be talking about what they want and what they need.
Andrew Maynard is director of the Risk Innovation Lab at ASU. He'll be in Washington, D.C. early next week for a discussion about potential technical solutions to deadly diseases like Zika. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Austria has introduced a cap on the number of migrants and refugees allowed into the country, despite top European officials describing it as, quote, plainly incompatible with EU law. A maximum of 80 asylum applications will be accepted per day at its southern border. EU leaders have announced they'll hold a summit in early March with Turkey to attempt to seek fresh solutions to the crisis. Up to this point, Austria had been considered a prime example of refugee settlement done well. That has led NAU professor Miguel Vasquez and his student Kirill Kirkov to plan a trip to Austria in the effort to produce a documentary. They're calling it the Austrian Refugee Integration Project, and they join me now. Miguel, what's the aim of the project in addition to the documentary?
To conduct workshops in what's known as RARE, Rapid Assessment, Response, and Evaluation. And this is a series of, it's mostly focus groups and interviews with refugees to find out their perspectives, their needs, to get it from, not from the bureaucratic perspective, but from the on-the-ground perspective of the people that are going through this ordeal.
Kirill, can you share with us a little bit about your experience? What are some of the difficult adjustments of being a refugee? Some people freely make the choice to go somewhere else, while others are forced to make a decision based on being in a dangerous situation.
There are two major parts of migration in terms of consequences that are experienced by all those hundreds of thousands of people. The first part is that you cut your roots. You're no longer in your known environment. You leave your country. But the meaning of this is that you leave your culture, you leave your language, you leave your, you know, everyday lifestyle, your friends, your known environment, and you have to go to the second major consequence, which is to adapt yourself to a new language, new behavior, new rules, new realities in many different meanings in terms of, economics, politics, religion. You know, there is a big difference between a mosque in Syria and a mosque in Austria.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of fear. There's a lot of lack of trust that goes into this because they've been sort of forced out of their homeland.
That's a very fine line. We talk about economic refugees. Well, you know, if you're starving to death or if you're threatened with, you know, with violence in your homeland, wherever that is, whether it's Mexico or the Middle East, how you exactly draw those lines is difficult. In terms of the Middle East, you know, we're talking about a lot of people coming from places like Iraq and Syria, where they're being bombed on a regular basis. And as a parent, as a grandparent, how do you make that decision? When do you make that decision that, you know what, I'm out of here. This is just an intolerable situation.
Kirill, what about the situation that comes, the differences between being an adult and a child? Can a child, even with some of this traumatic stuff, once a child gets settled in a new place, if there's a welcoming refugee system there, can children then make a great new life out of this, whereas maybe for adults it's more difficult because they've had more experiences in their homeland?
You're absolutely correct. Actually, my own daughter lives in England since her age of 5. Now she's 25, and she has adapted perfectly in England. But we have to remember that we talk about war refugees in general. There are more than 10,000 missing children today in Europe. If they have the proper support, if they receive the proper attitude by the government, institutions, individuals on a local scale, then they will be all right. But they're, I mean, those are children, especially children without parents. If they do not receive this support, then the consequences will be terrible. So we want to emphasize the meaning, I mean, the work of this is called Integration House in Vienna, that is working with those minors, and they have great success on a local scale. We just want to film them. We just want to share their story with the audience and to show that there is hope, but to make it real, we need effort on state level.
Kirill Kirkov is an anthropology student at NAU, also a former Bulgarian choreographer, and Miguel Vasquez is an anthropology professor at NAU. We've been talking about the Austrian Refugee Integration Project. And gentlemen, thank you both for the time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Despite Phoenix's relatively young age, there is history here, and some of it is hidden in plain sight. The show's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez looks a little closer at one of those places.
Walk through the heart of downtown Phoenix and you'll see skyscrapers everywhere. But if you stop, say, around Central Avenue and Monroe Street, you'll notice a two-floor structure in the middle of the block. That was once the Steinegger Building. Did you know this is among the oldest commercial buildings in Phoenix?
We're looking at the current appearance of the Steinegger Lodging House, which was built in 1890.
Roger Brevoort is an architectural historian. We walk down Monroe Street to check out this boarded-up old building.
In the 1890s, when Phoenix was in its formative days and lots of people coming to town, business was just getting started, the Steinegger Lodging House was a fairly prominent place to stay.
Brevoort says the two-story structure was originally a late Victorian-era building, named after its founder, Alexander Steinegger. The lodge had about a dozen rooms between both floors. It also had porches in front and back. By 1911, the rear porch was eliminated and the building was extended to double its size. It was sold several times after that and had a few names, including the Alamo Hotel and the St. Francis Hotel.
By the 1950s, it had gone from a rooming house to more of a transient house, and most people know it as the Golden West Hotel, which had a fairly seedy reputation in terms of housing lots of people.
In 2004, the hotel closed, and a year later, the bar on the first floor shut down. Since then, the place has been boarded up. The alleyway on the east end of the building is barricaded with a wall, but just low enough to see the details of the side brick wall.
If you look a little further back, you can see there's a change in the roof line, and that's where the 1911 addition starts.
For safety reasons, we can't go inside the building, but Brevoort says what's inside is a walk back through time.
There are a few vestiges of original detail still in there. The central corridor form is still there. And then most interesting inside, the 1890s staircase in the front, which has Victorian detailing, is still intact. And the 1911 staircase in the back, which is a very different staircase, but those two staircases are still there.
By the way, Brevoort says there is one other commercial building older than the Steinegger. The Fry Building on the corner of Washington and 2nd Streets is the oldest commercial structure in Phoenix, built in 1885. We know it best as Marley's Sports Grill. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you know things that you think we should know, please tell us about them. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Tomorrow night, unmanned aerial vehicle enthusiasts will gather in Phoenix for a race. Pilots will be flying aerial multi-rotors, although they try to keep them fairly close to the ground. Artist David Moquet is one of them. He got interested in drones a few years back when he needed a way to get a new camera angle for a documentary he was working on. David joins me. And how did you go from using these machines for your art to racing them?
About a year and a half ago, in September of 2014, a video came out from France that talked about drone racing. And for the first time, we saw these tiny little multi-rotors racing through woods. And that video was just insane. And for us in the community, it just totally inspired us to switch gears from very large and stable multi-rotors to these tiny, very nervous, very fast and nimble smaller multi-rotors that allowed us to really race them like jet fighter pilots.
How does it work? I mean, if you're racing in the air, it's not like you can set up lanes necessarily up there. So like, how does it work? How do you make sure that like everybody is playing fair, and how do you determine a winner?
Well, that's the beautiful thing. I mean, the sport is really, really new. And originally, we just started to look at the topography around us. So we would go into washes or canyons or out in nature and use cactuses or trees as demarcation
points.
Like
first one past the saguaro wins.
Exactly, or, you know, who goes faster around these three saguaros or these three trees. And then pretty soon we started putting gates. And as far as we're concerned, we started doing what everybody else was doing across the country, but it got progressively hotter and hotter. And so in the summer, we needed to fly at night. And of course, at night, you have no lights, and bushes became a lot more dangerous. So we started playing around with lights and setting up these light structures to delineate the course and to create these visuals, you know, that were even more interesting. And that sort of happened organically.
So the multi-racer that you're using, it's fairly small, can fit in the palm of your hand.
Yes.
How many of these are racing at a given time?
Well, we've been successfully doing 6 pilots at a time, and we're pushing 8, and we expect by the end of the year to be able to do 10.
And you're using a remote control to fly these?
Traditional remote control, just like you would use for RC airplane modeling, the same kind of technology that's been around for the last 50 years.
So what is the allure of doing this as opposed to doing something like an RCA airplane or like a remote-controlled car or boat or other types of races like that?
Right. The big difference here is FPV. It's first-person view. So these multi-rotors have a tiny little security camera within them, and we wear goggles or look at a monitor, and so we see what the multi-rotor sees. It's a first-person experience. It's a very immersive experience. Once you put the goggles on, you really feel like you're inside this multi-rotor, and as soon as you take off and start the race, you're inside of a video game, but it's not a video game. You're really out there. You're genuinely interfacing with it. It's quite exhilarating.
It sounds like a video game with like the world's best graphics.
Exactly. And so we're trying to take advantage of the environment around us and highlight it using light, you know, and to take advantage of the environment around us. And we're just beginning to play with that idea.
How does this relate to the work that you do as an artist?
It's just a natural evolution. A lot of the techniques that I've developed as an artist fit right in, especially the staging, the framing. I think everybody on my team, because of our artistic background and the other artists that we're seeking out to bring into this this group, that's what makes us different, is this ability to play and think outside the box.
What do you think is the ceiling of how popular this will become? I mean, do you think this could become something that, like, people who are not artists or people who are, you know, drone-type enthusiasts will see as something that they want to do?
I definitely think so. I mean, I'm not an expert on what is trendy or what is not trendy, but from the people that I've been playing with and working with, everybody is madly passionate about this thing. You can use the analogy of the millions of people that are watching a few people play video games, you know, online. This is something that is real and that has the same sort of passion and exhilarating factor than those video games, but it's real. For the price of an Xbox or a PlayStation, you can go out and build yourself one of these multi-rotors and compete professionally and go outside.
Artist David Moquet will be taking part in the Phoenix Cup. It's a race for multi-rotor unmanned aerial vehicles tomorrow night. We'll post a video of the course organizer set up at theshow.kjzz.org. There's a number to call if there's a snake in your yard. There's a hotline you can call for questions on how to cook your Thanksgiving turkey. There's even a number to find out if the roof is going to be open at a Diamondbacks game. But did you know there's a hotline to call to report a UFO?
National UFO Reporting Center.
That's Peter Davenport. He's director of the National UFO Reporting Center. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins recently gave him a call. Jimmy, did you have a sighting to report?
No, Mark. Despite my constant stargazing, I still haven't seen a UFO, and I'm pretty bummed about it. But I wanted to talk with Peter because it's the 25th anniversary of the International UFO Congress here in Phoenix. He's a past presenter, and he's spoken with so many people who have had sightings. He's had a website since 1998 where you can submit written accounts, but Peter says the UFO hotline still gets about 40 to 50 calls a day from all over the world. I asked him what it's like to be the guy on the other end of those calls.
Whenever they see something like that for the first time, there's a great deal of incredulity and oftentimes fear. And being able to provide them with a sympathetic ear to listen to their story is, I find, quite gratifying. It's one of the things that keeps me moving forward in this job.
What about the Southwest? What kinds of reports do you receive from our part of the country?
Probably the most dramatic one is the Phoenix Lights events, event of March 13, 1997. Probably, in my opinion, the most dramatic UFO event in the history of ufology. But there have been many others from the Arizona area. For example, just over a year ago, the night of the Super Bowl that was played in Glendale, I think, at the stadium in Glendale, a very dramatic sighting by a young woman who was taking the trash out at her home in Tempe, and she saw an object streaking to the north in the eastern sky from her vantage point. And as she tracked it, it made a sudden turn to the west, and she estimates it passed very close or over the stadium while the Super Bowl game was in process. But there have been many other equally interesting reports. One in particular is a report we received from a retired Arizona Highway Patrol officer. He had 35 years in with the Highway Patrol. He was standing in his home in Glendale, Arizona, looking to the north through a plate glass window, and was shocked to see a fireball streak from west to east, that is, from his right, from his left to his right. And he raced outside hoping to see it as it diminished to the, or continued its travel to the east. And while he stood there, another cluster went by. All told, in his report, he describes that he saw an estimated 150 of those orange fireballs.
What do you hope visitors to the site would take away from this body of information that you've collected?
Probably the most important message addresses what I consider to be the most important scientific question in the history of mankind. Namely, are we alone in this universe and galaxy, or are we not? And the principal advantage of collecting this information on UFO sightings is it answers, or goes a long way towards answering, that question. Clearly, we are being visited. Clearly, we are not alone in the universe. I have collected approximately 113,000 written reports, and we're receiving approximately 20 to 30 reports per day.
Despite the number of people that contact you, there are still going to be skeptics out there. What do you say to them?
We UFO investigators are saying that we're being visited by intelligent creatures on our planet, probably, I suspect, on a daily basis. That's what the data say. Many people are skeptical, and that's fine, but I observe that most of those people who remain skeptical are the very ones who've never taken the time to look at the data.
You can find that data at the National UFO Reporting Center's website, and you can report your own sighting on the hotline. We'll link to both on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. Peter Davenport, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. I enjoyed it.
That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jimmy.
My pleasure, Mark.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.